So we conclude then in Job as we come to at last the arrival of the Lord. The Lord, of course, spoke in the book, in the prologue, way back there in chapters 1 and 2, in heaven. But here now, he appears at last on earth. And as you will remember, he does so in response to Job's demands, as it were. Job, in his dialogues with his friends, in his frustration at his suffering that he feels is so unjust, so unfair, has, in accordance with the conventions of the time, demanded that the Lord appear in court. He has taken a lawsuit out against God and demanded that he appears to answer his questions in court. And then, in his monologues, as we considered last week, then Job has, as it were, gone even further by swearing an oath or a series of oaths of innocence. He has sworn that he has done nothing to deserve what he had. And in fact, if he has done any, and he lists all those sort of different sins, if he has done these things, may the Lord punish him, he says, in these ways. And in this way too, then, in accordance with the conventions of the day, the oath was to prove publicly, or attempt for Job to prove publicly, that he was innocent, an innocent sufferer. And then we had the intervention of Elihu, kind of delaying the appearance of the Lord to make it clear that the Lord is appearing in his own time. And at the end of Elihu's discourses, Elihu announces the appearance of the Lord in chapter 37. He sees then the thunderclouds in the distance. He sees the storm coming down from the north. He sees then the Lord Almighty coming to speak. And so the Lord then appears, as we have read in chapter 38. He speaks, he answers Job out of the whirlwind. The whirlwind, or the tempest, or the storm. He came out of the north to Ezekiel in that whirlwind, as he appeared on Mount Sinai in that great storm and so on. The Lord appears in this. It's a characteristic way of the Lord manifesting his presence in a way that shows his power, his majesty, the lightning, the thunder and so on, and yet also conceals his glory in the storm clouds. So the Lord appears and speaks to Job. And he says to him then, dress for action like a man, or in the old-fashioned translations, the lovely, gird up your loins then, Job, gird up your loins. A phrase that was used then for wrestling in one-to-one combats. If you were dressed then in long robes, then you'd need to lift them up and stick them in your belts, so that you were ready then to not be hindered, you were ready to engage in one-to-one combat. Now this is of course metaphorical for the legal combat that Job has demanded to engage in with the Lord. He has wanted, as it were, to wrestle with God, to take him on in the law court. So the Lord appears and says, okay, prepare yourself for this and answer my questions. Job has said earlier, he said, look, appear, Lord, and I'll ask you questions and then you can ask me questions. So the Lord says, okay, I'll question you now, Job, and let's see what answers you've got to my questions. And of course, the first question that the Lord asks Job is that majestic put-down, isn't it? Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? And he, as it were, he just lays Job flat in the dust with his first question. A question that, of course, humbles us all. A question that every cosmologist and scientist of this day would do well to ponder as we try to probe the wonders of creation. Where were you when I created the heavens and the earth, says the Lord? And the Lord then, of course, continues with a whole lot of cosmological questions through this chapter, through verses 4 to 21. He brings this barrage of questions related to the creation week and the Lord's activity there. We have all these questions about light and darkness, about the laying out of the oceans and the establishing of the land in this poetry, about the Lord, you know, he laid the boundaries of all these things and shaped the earth like clay. All this sort of language that we have in the Psalms, the creation Psalms and so on. The Lord then springs these questions to Job, and says, well then, Job, you know, answer these questions. And after this barrage of cosmological questions, he moves on to the meteorological questions. There's questions about the weather from verses 22 to 30. Questions about then the snow, the ice, the rain, the lightning, all these things. And then he briefly moves on to astronomy. He points to the heavenly bodies above, to the constellations of the stars in the sky. And he asks Job questions again that are unanswerable for Job about these things. And then he returns in verse 34 to further meteorological questions. More things about the clouds and the rain and so on that Job cannot answer. And then he moves on to zoology in verse 39, where he speaks of the lion, and he goes on to speak of many other animals through chapter 39, questions about ravens, questions about ostriches, questions about hawks and eagles and so on, all sorts of zoological questions. Questions not about animals Job thinks he might know about, so he doesn't ask him about sheep and goats, for example, not domestic. These are all wild animals that Job doesn't know about, because the point of all these questions, this rhetorical barrage then that the Lord brings, is that Job is unable to answer any of these questions. I've likened this before to the quiz program Mastermind that used to be on, I'm not sure if it still runs, where you'd sit in that chair under spotlight, be asked all these questions. If you couldn't answer, you'd say pass. Well, it's always pass for Job. After question, he doesn't know and isn't meant to know, is it, with the answers to any of these things. So what's the point then of this? Why does the Lord do this? Now, of course, at one level, he's just simply pointing out what we'd see is pretty obvious, that the Lord is far more knowledgeable than Job. He knows about all these things. Job doesn't. He's much more knowledgeable. He's the omniscient God. But of course, the point in context is, in particular, the Lord has the wisdom to manage these things, to govern these things. And the Job has been questioning the Lord's government. He's been questioning the Lord's ability to wisely rule his universe, hasn't he? And so these questions are to display to Job that he lacks the knowledge and therefore the wisdom, the know-how to run the universe, that the Lord has the wisdom that he doesn't have. Or to put it in modern vernacular, he's sort of saying to Job, look, Job, these things about governing the universe, they're way above your pay grade, Job. They're way above your pay grade. You can't ask me these questions. It's absurd. You imagine then a cleaner in an office of a huge multinational, multi-billion dollar company. And she's there kind of cleaning the floor and starts griping about the company because she's heard it criticized on the news. And she says how bad her lot is and complains about a company and how it's run. And of course, it just so happens then that the chief executive of this multinational company happens to be nearby, and he overhears all her whinging. And so he comes to her and he says, oh, so you think I run this company badly? Do you think I'm not able to govern this huge organization? Okay, well, tell me what you know about monetary theory. Tell me what you think about the current state of inflation in the United Kingdom and its impact on my multinational company. What's your theory about the best way to do due diligence? And she, of course, can't answer any of these questions. And he continues, you know, what do you know about quantitative easing? Explain this to me. Well, it's like this. The Lord is just saying to Job, you don't know how to do any of these things. You're questioning me and you're way out of your depth. Just like that cleaner, you can't possibly think you know how to run such an organization at your level of knowledge. You're too ignorant. And so the Lord then brings this barrage to make this point very forcefully then to Job. And so we have then, as we enter chapter 40, Job's response. He is appropriately humbled, isn't he? We read in chapter 40, Job answers the Lord and says, Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once and will not answer twice, but I'll proceed no further. Job is humbled and he concedes he can't answer. He puts his hand over his mouth. He is silent. Job, remember, was a wise man. We've been told he is a great exemplar of wisdom. We've been told earlier, right at the beginning of the book, what a wise, upright, godly man he is. So on one level, Job is a man with great wisdom. He's a man then, we could say, who can govern his own life. He's a man, we could see, who could govern his family's life well. He was a man, it seemed, who could govern as an employer well, rule over and govern all his servants. He was in these ways a good wise man and much wiser than most or probably all of us. But of course, it's a completely different level of wisdom that the Lord has been talking about. But the issue for you and me isn't, do we have the wisdom then to run the universe? It is, do we have the wisdom to manage our own lives? The Lord has given you and me the wisdom, or the ability to grow in the wisdom, to know how to manage myself, to know how to govern myself, to control myself and my behaviour. That's how wisdom relates to us, practically. Job was wise at that level, the level we need to operate, but not, of course, at the level of management or government of the universe. So Job lacks the wisdom, and he's humbled, but the Lord, of course, isn't finished. We might expect to have finished now and to move on to the epilogue, but the Lord hasn't finished. We have round two. We have round two of this barrage of unanswerable questions from the Lord. The Lord answered Job in verse 6 of chapter 40. Again, he speaks then out of the storm. He says again, gird up your loins, Job. Gird up your loins. Here we go again, round two. The poor Job had to get up and dust himself down, as it were, put in his garments and his belt again, and he's ready for round two. And round two, again, there are these questions, but of course they're different, aren't they? Here the structure is clearer. There's three main parts. First of all, then, in verses 8 to 14, the Lord asks questions about Job's ability to crush, to humble into the dust, wicked, powerful people. Can you humble, can you put them in their dust, he says. And then he moves on in verse 15, as we read, to this creature Behemoth, this strong, this powerful creature whom he describes, and then concludes by making the point that, of course, whilst he, the Lord, can control this creature he's made, Job hasn't got a chance of taming or managing this mighty creature. And in the next chapter, having spoken of this mighty land animal, Behemoth, he speaks of this mighty sea creature, Leviathan, whom again is described at great length. And again, the point is, here we have this powerful and ungovernable creature by you, Job. You wouldn't dare touch him and try and direct this creature, would you? He would destroy you in an instant. The Lord, of course, he can govern Behemoth, he can govern Leviathan and so on. Job, no chance. He lacks the strength, he lacks the power to do this. But why then this second part? What's the point of these questions? Well, I think one of the difficulties we have with this is that we have what's called the separation of powers. That is, the government is separate from the judicial system. So if we ask who rules in the land, then we'll say, well, it's the government through parliament that rules in our land. But if you've committed some crime, then you'll be dealt with by judges and magistrates in the judicial system, which is separate from the government ruling system. And this is familiar to us in democracies. It's a better separation, of course, in the United States because we have the confusion of the House of Lords where judges sit and bring the two together. But there's essentially a separation. But in the societies that Job and his friends lived in ancient Israel and the other nations, there was no such separation, was there? This comes to always be a problem when you read the book of Judges. They'll have in the English footnotes, judges or also ruler. Because, of course, the judges, They were men who not only exercised justice, as we would understand a judge, they didn't only make decisions about matters of law and right and wrong, but of course they ruled, they led armies to victory and so on. They led fights and war against the surrounding nations. They were rulers as well as judges. They were combined, what we have then, these separate powers. And it was, of course, the same with the kings of Israel, like the kings of surrounding nation. They ruled as the head of government, the head of state, but they were also the supreme judge in the nation, Solomon being the most well-known example, but it was the same for all the kings in Israel and Judah. They were the judges, the supreme judge, as well as the supreme ruler in the land. And in order to function then as ruler, in order to function as king, then you obviously needed to have the power. The man who was king was generally the most powerful man, the one who was the best at fighting and leading armies and so on in those societies. The most powerful, authoritative, the strong man was the king, the ruler. To function, though, in the law courts, to function as judge, you needed particularly wisdom. As Solomon recognized, you needed great wisdom to do that. So to do all these things, that is to both function as ruler and to function as judge, you needed great wisdom and great power. And the point the Lord then is making as the supreme king and ruler and judge in the universe is that he is supreme in wisdom and in power. So the first sort of barrage of questions is emphasizing the supremacy of the Lord's wisdom, with all these unanswerable questions. And the second part is the Lord's unanswerable power, his ability to rule and do these things. Job can't crush others. He can't crush the wicked. He doesn't have the strength, the power. He can't rule these creatures. But of course, the Lord can. He is the powerful one. But you might still say, you might object, but is this relevant? Is this actually relevant to the point that Job has made? Job's complained about God's justice, hasn't he? Job has complained about the way he's been treated. He's saying, I haven't done anything wrong, and I've suffered so terribly. I've been greatly afflicted as an innocent man. You're not just. You're not fair, Lord. But none of the questions that we have are about human beings. They're not questions about right and wrong, are they? None of them are moral questions at all. They're not questions about justice in the way that we would normally understand it, to do with decisions about right and wrong, towards convicting the guilty and acquitting the innocent, and so on. These questions are all about the physical universe, as we would call it. They're about, as we've seen, matter zoological and cosmological and so on. They're nothing to do with human beings, and they're nothing to do with the moral questions that Job has raised of God's government. So how is this relevant, what the Lord is doing, to what Job has actually demanded in calling God to come? Well, the answer, I think, essentially is that whilst the Lord can ask Job questions about the physical government of the universe, he can't really begin to talk to Job about the moral government of the universe. The physical government of the universe, ruling the heavenly bodies, ruling Leviathan and so on, this is child's play, as we would say. This is easy for the Lord, as it were. But ruling millions, billions of individual human beings, each of us every day, making all sorts of decisions and interacting with one another, that's immensely more complicated, isn't it? Far more difficult. So to try and illustrate. William, as you know, is a mathematics teacher and one who enjoys his math. Now, you imagine one day that at home, then young James says to him, he's looked at one of his books, and he asks his dad about this quadratic equation. And he says, Dad, can you explain to me about quadratic equations? And William thinks, well, this is going to be a bit tricky. He's doing all right with his arithmetic, but, you know, matters of algebra and quadratic equations, this is going to be a bit tough. But, you know, he sits down and he tries to illustrate with a few graphs and draw them out and explain what they mean and how they work and so on. And he attempts then to communicate this to James. But then James has seen something interesting that his dad's been reading, and this is something called quantum mechanics. And he says, now, there's this thing about strings. Can you tell me about this superstring theory, Dad? An M theory, and what is this about? And now William realises he's got a real problem, because he knows that you can't explain superstring theory in the English language. You can't explain it in any language other than the language of mathematics. That it's only advanced mathematics that you can communicate about superstring and M theory in these advanced levels of quantum mechanical theory. So William then thinks, well, how can I possibly engage in any kind of conversation with James about these things? He wouldn't have a clue what these massive page-long equations are and what they might mean. I can't speak in English about them. It's impossible. I can't even begin to talk to him about them. Well, it's a bit like that here. You see, the Lord can ask questions to Job that Job can understand about his government of the physical universe. Job's understanding is pretty limited. He can't really answer the questions, but at least there's some kind of engagement. At least there's some kind of interaction. The Lord can at least ask the questions, like William can attempt to explain quadratic theory to James. Might be a bit difficult, but he can at least begin to try. The Lord can try and explain it with these questions. But when it comes to the moral government of the universe, the Lord can't even begin a conversation. It's far too difficult. Way, way above Job's ability to understand. So much so that, like trying to explain superstring theory to a child, you just can't even begin to ask questions. You can't even begin to explain about it. So I don't think that what the Lord is doing in all these questions is irrelevant then to Job's position. And I think Job understands this. He's bowing before the majesty of the Lord, before his supremacy in power and wisdom, and recognizing that actually the far more complex questions he has been raising about the moral government of the universe and how he has come to suffer in this way that seems to him to be so unfair, well, he can't really engage in an argument with the Lord about this. It's way, way beyond his understanding. There's a related question as well that you might ask and people ask, which is, why doesn't the Lord come along and say to Job at the end, well, let me tell you why this happened, and essentially go back to the prologue and say to Job, well, you know, one day Satan came along and he issued this challenge to me, and I took up his challenge, and so I allowed Satan to afflict you, and so on. Why didn't the Lord do this? Well, would it answer the questions? The fact we know the prologue, does that really answer the questions for us? I mean, does it seem fair that Job is dealt with like this at all? Why Job? I mean, why not someone else? There have been other upright people that the Lord could have allowed to be afflicted in the history of the world. Why Job? And as I say, why allow it at all? Well, it does seem so unfair. The fact we have the explanation doesn't make it just from where we are, does it? So I don't think it would answer, that's my point, I don't think it would answer Job at all. It wouldn't really help him to get to the point, which is that we are utterly unable to begin to engage with the Lord about his government of the universe. Knowing the prologue wouldn't answer Job's dilemma. But of course the book, as we've seen before at the beginning in our first sermon, doesn't finish then with poor Job humbled into the dust. At the end then of the second round of questions, the Lord's finished speaking, and Job then responds to him at the beginning of 42, and he confesses that that the Lord has humbled him. I know you can do all things, that no purpose of yours can be thwarted, and so on. He confesses he shouldn't be asking all these questions because he can't engage in this discussion with the Lord. So he repents, that he withdraws all that he said to the Lord. Now, perhaps some of you may have had difficulty with my interpretation in saying that Job hasn't ever sinned. But you think of young James asking his father these questions. Now, William sort of can't respond and is unable to respond. And James starts getting frustrated and saying, "You must tell me. You've got to explain this to me." And gets angry with his father for not explaining it. Now, would we say that he's been wicked for that? Would his father punish him for that? No, because he recognises his frustration, but his frustration is born of his limitations. It's not morally wrong, or not necessarily morally wrong. In the same way, Job is frustrated. He loves the Lord. He's obeyed him with his heart and soul all his life. And he's frustrated. And so he brings all these questions that we've seen. But remember, in the epilogue, as we see, he is vindicated by the Lord. The Lord declares that he has been right and his friends have been wrong, and so on. And so, as it were, to come full circle, we come to the essential point that I touched on a few minutes ago, which is about moral wisdom for us, self-governing wisdom, that Job does exemplify throughout. That it's not about trying to understand and know the answers. It's about trusting and serving the Lord whom we know. We're not called to explain, and we can't understand. But what we can do is imitate Job in where he was right, in trusting and clinging on through all the pain and agony to his God. He was a man, as we've seen, who remained faithful, he remained true, and remains an example to us of patience through suffering, as James says. And that's where we learn from Job, that we may be frustrated with pain and anguish in our life. We might feel and speak like Job, and that might be okay in our frustration, but ultimately we must keep trusting and serving through the pain, because that's what Job did. That's where Job was right, not because he could explain, not because he was clever, but because he was faithful and true as a servant of the Lord. So we close then with number 800 in the hymn book, which takes up then again this theme of trusting in the Lord, of submitting to his will. Leave God to order all thy ways, and hope in him whate'er betide.